This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the Youth Leadership Platform. And you are with your host, Bongani Tau, at Simply Bongani across all social media. We are very excited, this being our first episode for the year 2018. And I have some wonderful guests. We're speaking dynamic leadership in moving society. And as per usual, I'll start with introducing my guests and we'll take it from there. So to my left, I've got the wonderful from Gibbs and lovely Fazlin. And to my right, or directly in front of me, if you may, I've got another lovely, and you know, she's got a beautiful big smile.
Oh, wow.
Lulega. So guys, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming through. Kindly introduce yourselves to the Youth Leadership Platform listeners.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm Fazlin Taufi.
Yes.
I always introduce myself like this and I get flack for it, but I'm a failed entrepreneur and it's a badge I wear very proudly.
Okay.
So people often ask, why do you introduce yourself like that? Because sure. There's positives after all of the negative, after all of the gunk. So the reason I work at the Gibbs Enterprise Development Academy, Entrepreneurship Development Academy, sorry, is because my mission in this world is to allow more entrepreneurs to fail,
okay,
so that it's not a bad thing, but to fail from that, to learn from that failure.
Yes.
So first day back at the office for 2018, my kind of mantra is keep celebrating the failure so that you can celebrate the success.
Sure.
And that's essentially what I'd like to chat with you guys about alongside Lulega
awesome.
Today.
Awesome. Awesomeness. Lulega.
Thank you very much, Bongani, for having me here.
Yes.
I'm very honored to be here. My name is Lulega, and I like to introduce myself by saying that I am a rural girl.
Okay.
I am from a community called Gopa in the Eastern Cape, which is between Flagstaff and Bizana.
Okay.
I was lucky to have parents who had a home in Durban where we could go to and then study there for university.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got employed by a mining company in Durban.
Yes.
Relocated to Johannesburg after a few years, where I stayed here for about 3 years. And then I enrolled on the Gibbs Social Entrepreneurship Program.
Yeah.
And then that program sort of gave me the push I needed.
So it was a launch pad.
It was a launch pad.
Okay.
Yes.
So let's get a bit into your lives before we get into, you know, the nitty gritties of today's conversation. So Faz, you spoke very little about your background and the journey leading up to you playing this role at Gibbs. So kindly take us through that.
Ah, so very colorful journey. Like Lulega, I worked in mining.
Uh-huh.
I was seconded to go and live and work in West Africa in Guinea.
Gee.
A country I'd never heard of before.
Uh-huh.
But being the entrepreneur with big girl panties on, I took on the opportunity.
Sure.
Had the most amazing experience. So this was as an entrepreneur. My business was called Chili and Lime. I was doing amazing work in community development, communications, allowing corporates to take their kind of marketing spend,
yes,
and use it in more of a conscious way,
okay,
while still getting the traction,
sure,
the marketing spend traction kind,
sure,
of thing. But doing good while doing that. I didn't realize there's a term for that, and that's called social entrepreneurship.
Okay.
So I was in Guinea for a year, did this work, learned the hardest and the best decision lessons in my life. And then I came back and SARS knocked on my door. And that was the first time in my life as a young entrepreneur, I realized, oh, you pay taxes? So we were shut down. So we were unceremoniously shut down and I needed to find a job. And I'd started my career at Gibbs. I worked in the company specific program many years ago.
Yes.
So I went back home and I said, look, I failed as an entrepreneur. Can I have a job here? And they offered me a job and it was in a department where we were supporting entrepreneurs. At the time, it was only social entrepreneurs.
Okay.
Today, we've grown to supporting commercial, social through sponsorships, through paid programs, etc.
Yeah.
But that was my first insight into what you should know that you don't know.
Mm. Okay.
And that was kind of where the entrepreneurial kind of journey ended, but didn't die.
Yes.
So then I realized that I needed to surround myself around those who know and those who know that they don't know, but we're kind of gathering information.
Sure.
So worked at Gibbs, went on to start my next own business again. And at the time I was running three businesses. One was a organizing business. The other one was an app, social entrepreneurship app. Failed again, but this time I failed better.
Okay.
And I didn't fail as expensively as the first time. But the lessons I learned, and I documented them. I don't journal, unfortunately, or else could have probably sold it for a bit of money. but the lessons
I
learned
going to come up in a book, though.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. Multi-million rand best-selling author labels. But then I went off on my own again, started an organization, an NGO that supports youth entrepreneurs.
Yes.
I worked at an organization that supports youth entrepreneurs in school, but then realized that teachers were saying, do you want to pass math or do you want to be an entrepreneur? Like it was a bad thing, like it was a swear word. We then, friends of mine and I started an organization to support youth entrepreneurs, but not making it a bad thing.
Okay.
Making it an exemplary kind of career. Sure. Nobody saw it as a career. They saw it as, oh, it's a synonym for unemployed or self-employed was, yeah.
Yeah.
It was that kind of seen in that vein. So then enter the Gibbs Entrepreneurship Development Academy. What we do is supporting entrepreneurs across various different life stages in their business, the mainstream, the commercial, and the social entrepreneurs.
Okay.
But being a business school, we educate, we support them through education.
Yes.
And that was why I came here, because it was the education around that I need to pay tax. It was the education around that I need to have financial systems in place that I lacked in my business.
From the lessons that you learned the hard way. As an entrepreneur.
The hard way.
Lulega?
So, yeah, my journey started, as I said, that Gibbs gave me the push that I needed. Coming from a rural community.
But prior to that, prior to coming up with the idea that ended up winning you the prize money that you won, that we're going to get into in the conversation, we want to know
about
what happened before then.
So, what happened before then is coming from a rural community.
Yes.
You only see a computer when you go to varsity.
Yes.
So there's no resources. You go to varsity, you exposed to all these resources that you do not know how to use.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone expects you to know everything.
Sure.
Then your confidence levels become so short because you feel like, okay, I don't know. What am I going to contribute here? So you're so intimidated by everyone around you. So then growing up in that environment, then I started working for the mining company. But in the mining company, then I kept being the nega employee who's always telling the bosses that, you know what, rural communities need help.
Yeah.
We need to do A, B, and C for rural communities. And I was lucky that for the company that I worked for, my bosses would be open into some of the ideas that I would suggest.
Mm-hmm.
So I started being in procurement, but doing programs that were not in my job scope.
Okay.
Programs that would uplift communities. But then still, with the programs, I was still very charity-driven programs, that they were not programs where I could leave people and they can be sustainable programs.
Let me interrupt you just there. I want to get into, you know, a lot of people, we especially from black pre-disadvantaged communities, people just want to fend for themselves and just leave that disadvantageous background and never look back. So what inspired you to say, I actually want to help?
So what inspired me is that coming from that community, my mom wanted to send us into sorts of semi-private schools, but she couldn't afford to pay for us in those schools. So she would have to go and look for money because she didn't have credit from banks to get loans because her credit record was so horrible. So she had to go to our aunts and uncles and at times go to our community.
Okay.
So our community would have their children going to rural schools where there's nothing, but they would still contribute money to my mom to send us to schools in semi-private schools in Durban. So that then, I think for me, sort of put a seed in me that said, you know, I want to grow up and I actually want to do something for my community.
Ubuntu.
I want to bring back something to my community.
Yeah.
Yes.
The spirit of Ubuntu,
yes.
So continue from where you left off. You started with a lot of charity organizations.
Yes, and doing charitable work, but inside the mining company.
Okay.
Doing a lot of, going back, every time I was on leave, I would go home, and then at home, I would tell, I think also my family, Shema, I felt sorry for them, because I'm always doing all this work, and they always have to come along with me and help me while doing it. So I started doing these things, but still, it was like change is not coming. because I was not knowledgeable enough to drive change that's going to be sustainable.
Sure.
So then I went into the social entrepreneurship program at Gibbs.
Yes.
And then the program, I think, is the one that sort of educated me that in doing initiatives, I need to launch initiatives that can actually drive transformation. But at the same time, communities must also embrace the solution. Mm-hmm. And then they must know that the solution is their solution.
Okay.
They must run the initiatives, and it must be sustainable enough that we're not a charity case, that we can drive our own change, but also try and make money out of the initiative that we're doing. Mm. So then in 2016, after I finished my Gibbs program, that's when then I made the decision to resign from the mining company and focus on running the programs themselves that I do in rural communities. Mm.
So we'll get into the festival itself. Let's get a bit of a background and an understanding of how did this festival come about, what brought about the idea, and what purpose does it serve?
So social entrepreneurship is still a really unknown concept in South Africa.
Okay.
Because, and touched on this, it's, am I a charity or am I making money?
Yeah.
And people see it as two very opposite ends of the pole and almost enemies of each other. And we then realized, and that's why the start of the social entrepreneurship program, for example, you can do good while still making money.
Okay.
You can drive the Beamer or the whatever car you aspire to driving, and you can still be doing, paying back your community in the way that Luleka is.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that. So that was the starting point for Gibbs, is to create the SEP, the Social Entrepreneurship Program. But then we realized that a lot of older people who've been exposed to it for a little longer are becoming social entrepreneurs and are forgiving themselves for being social entrepreneurs.
Mm.
Younger people don't know the concept. Younger people aren't aspiring to becoming social entrepreneurs because they don't know it.
Yeah.
They know lawyer, teacher, doctor kind of as a career.
True.
So we then realized that there needs to be something that inspires the creation of ideas, the support of ideas, and festival ideas was created.
Hmm.
So it happens every year around Global Entrepreneurship Week, which is in November. But leading up to that, we do applications. And it's not, we don't want to bog people down with paper.
Mm.
So it's a voice note or a video kind of interview or application. And you tell us what your idea is. Most of the ideas are not fully baked cakes.
Yes.
But that's the idea of the festival. And Luleka can contest to that or confirm. Contest. That through the process, even just your putting that idea on a video or a voice note starts having you work through your idea yourself. And then you go, so who am I going to supply this to?
Yes.
Why?
Yes.
For how much money?
Yes.
I need to live. Mm. I need to get to Durban and Eastern Cape, for example.
Yeah.
And then once you're selected, the process then walks you through workshops on how you're going to make this a reality.
Mm.
Mm. There's no point in just having a festival and just having an idea and just winning 55,000 rand. But you need to make that a reality.
Mm-hmm.
Or you need to take that money and seed it into the idea that you've already started.
Mm.
And that's how the festival ideas.
So when do registrations start, and how do young entrepreneurs get into the program or apply?
So the call goes out around September.
Okay.
The call goes out around the 1st of September. This year it was the 1st of September. And it goes out to most kind of, my job at Gibbs is marketing. So my job is to go out and talk about what it is that we're currently doing.
Okay.
What's exciting for the young people. So obviously it goes out in ways that are exciting to the young person.
Mm-hmm.
Social media, radio shows like this one,
mm-hmm.
that speak to young people.
Yes.
And it tells them exactly what it is that they'll need to have to apply. So have you got an idea? You
yes.
can't come there with no ideas.
Yeah.
The festival of ideas.
Yeah.
And then it walks you through the sense of we'll workshop that idea so it becomes an actual thing.
Mm.
Okay.
That you can put a name to and say that is my legacy. So around the 1st of October of September, we start that process, the open call. From about the 1st of October, we do interviews. So it's not necessarily physical interviews with you. There are people who come to us from various other provinces in the country, and we just want to get a sense of why do you want to do this.
Yes.
There's no point in giving the 55,000 to somebody who just laid in bed and was bored.
Yeah.
But are you going to continue to be inspired to make this social entrepreneurship venture happen?
Hmm.
And yes, it's going to fail probably, or it's going to be massively successful probably, but you need to know that within you, you've got what it takes. And then from about the 1st of November, we start with the workshops. This was 2017 timeline, but it's about the same every year, because we want to coincide it with Global Entrepreneurship Week.
Mm.
where all of South Africa, all of the world is looking at how are we going to support entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And then from about the 1st of November, we have the workshops where the shortlisted 50 come. And this year we had about 400 applications. We shortlist that to 50 and they come and they workshop. And that's when they start meeting each other. Mm-hmm. So Luleka speaks often, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, about the network. As a social entrepreneur, even as an entrepreneur, it's a lonely, lonely, lonely journey. Mm. You are on your ace. Mm. So when you get to that workshop with 49 other people like you, you are on your ace in this community of people.
Yes.
And then you do the festival. The festival happens during that week of Global Entrepreneurship Week. So it's around the 14th, 15th. And you pitch. So this is a nerve-wracking process. But I'm not going to say just how nerve-wracking. Luleka will tell us. But you pitch to people who have heard and seen it all. These are people who've worked as social entrepreneurs in the social entrepreneurship space. And they want to know why I should give my 55,000 to you.
To you.
Mm-hmm. And those who succeed like Luleka get to the top and get that prize money.
I wanted you to tell us about the winning idea. What are the makings of a winning idea? But before then, Luleka, what idea then was born in your mind that took you all the way to the finals and more than anything, winning the entire competition and, you know, going further to serve your community the way you do?
So I think I started in 2015. I started engaging with my communities. I currently work with three communities in the Eastern Cape. So from 2015, I started meeting with the chiefs and the community leaders, meeting with the youth and the older people from communities, and then also talking to the schools and the school principals. Then what came out, one of the biggest things that came out was how our communities are not benefiting from technology whatsoever because of the lack of the infrastructure.
Sure.
So then my idea then was, what can we do then? How can we actually bring in technology to help us with some of the challenges that we're having in the community?
Sure.
And what I realized was that in Johannesburg, there's a lot of buzz around mobile businesses.
Sure.
And with this mobile businesses, because our biggest problem was that we couldn't put resources in schools because our infrastructure in schools, there's no security. So if you go to funders or sponsors or companies and ask them, maybe we need computers or we need this, they'll tell you if there's no security, we can't put anything in there because it's going to disappear within a week.
Okay.
So then with this mobile buzz, then I was like, oh, actually, maybe we can use the mobile concept into driving something like computer mobile classes.
Okay.
Then we can use the computer mobile classes to assist people into going into online and then applying for online courses, looking for bursaries, finding jobs online, connecting through social media and sort of putting their profiles out there for the world to see. Because our biggest thing is that we're so isolated from the rest of the world that no one knows that we exist in our little corner.
Sure.
So then I started then, I wanted then to pilot this idea. So I again approached our rural leaders and told them that this is what I think we should try out, and they were very excited. So they were saying, yes, we want you to try it out. I approached the Department of Education and I said, okay, this is the idea I have, can you give me authorization to pilot it in your schools? Then the department said, yes, you can go to the schools. So then I spoke to the school principals and the school principals said, come. So in piloting the idea, I wanted to pilot it for the students. But then when I started it, then the school principal said, well, the teachers also want to come into your classes because they also want to learn. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, but I don't think they're going to want to sit in the class with the students. And the principals said, no, they actually want to sit with the students because they want to learn. So then now what happens is that you'll find a student and a teacher sitting on the desk helping each other out while I'm running the class. Mm. And then the community, and the unemployed graduates and the older people said, okay, but why don't you do a separate group, because us as the community also want to be part of the program.
Yes.
So can we also have a class that is made up of the people from the community?
Sure.
So then now what I do, then I create a group from the community, then I create a group that is students with teachers. Mm. So when I'm running the program in a community, I'll probably maybe have three classes that have time slots within the groups for like the week. Then that's how I started piloting the idea. And then other schools heard of what I'm doing. Then other schools now want me to come to their communities and to run the program. Mm. But what's exciting now, I was just telling Fazlin, that now I've also been invited by the Department of Health, because they've said, can you come and please teach our employees. So in the past week, I was teaching some of the kitchen employees and nurses and matrons and nursing managers how to actually use computers, because they've got computers, but their people don't know how to use the computers. So they're saying they find it less intimidating if the person comes into their environment and runs the classes from there.
And I mean, we're moving into a digital age.
Yes.
Clip Central itself is an online platform-based platform, and a lot of the youth from those areas do not have access and do not have, they lack the skill and the information that is needed, which is a very fascinating concept and idea. So tell us one story of someone that, you know, through everything that you've done with this program, you've seen them move from where they were to a better place.
So where they were to a better place. So, okay, the program, I ran it for grade sevens, from grade sevens. So grade sevens, eights and nines. And then I ran it for teachers. And then now I started with the Department of Health. So for students, what I would say is nice with the students is that when I go, because students normally in rural communities don't have mentors.
Okay.
So now with the programs, then I'm sort of incorporating that mentorship space within the program, that when I run it, then students, I give them that thing that, okay, if you want to have a mentor, then please come to me and then I'll allocate you someone that is a mentor. So now we've got one of the last school I did last year, we had a student who's the top med student in the district of Alfonso. So being the top student, he doesn't have any type of guidance as to, okay, now I'm the top student, but how am I going to move forward here? And that's what happens, that students, no matter how intelligent they are, they're going to
they
pass,
lost in,
then nothing's going to happen, because there's no guidance or mentorship whatsoever.
They fall through the cracks.
They fall through the cracks. So now what's happened with the student, I've been able to link him to someone who works here in Johannesburg at Telkom, to sort of the guys Mthokozisi. He's mentoring the student, and he's sort of holding the student by the hand, and he's going to lead the students as to what subjects do you need, because one of the biggest problem, and students are always asking me, so miss, if I want to be a pilot, what subjects do I need to take? Because no one is advising us in schools that this is the career that you want to take, these are the subjects that you need to take. I've sort of pulled people on board there, that we need you to come and help us with career guidance, that students know which subjects to take. So from the program, I think I've been able to advise students on career guidance, subjects that they must take, and I'm able to link students with mentorship with people.
And how do students access your program?
So currently, people access it through principals, because in the Eastern Cape, we don't have online platforms.
Okay.
Currently, my computers are what we're going to use to sort of link with other people.
Okay.
But what happens is when I go to the school, and also because I've got a relationship with the Department of Education.
Yes.
So when I go to the school will sort of word of mouth program, tell another school that, okay, she's ran the program. But also what I do is I do reports. After each and every program that I've done, I'll do a report. I'll send it to the director of the Department of Education. He knows what's happened in that program. So those reports then get circulated as well, and they go to other schools.
Faz, what are the makings of a winning idea? Maybe I can ask the question better. What are some challenges that the youth of South Africa is facing that we need social entrepreneurs to address?
So very recently, we realized that green economy is becoming a really big thing. Things like the water shortage in Cape Town, or globally, but we see it pronounced in Cape Town. The fact that agriculture is not sexy anymore for anybody, but especially not the young people. So, for example, this year or last year, 2017's competition was focused on social and green.
Sure.
Because we want to get young people conscious again about what's important.
Okay.
That's important. But issues like education, healthcare are still very important issues for a social entrepreneur, especially a young social entrepreneur. Mm. Every issue that you grapple with, so whether it's the guy Mululeka was just speaking about now, who doesn't know what he's going to do with his excellent maths results, that's career guidance. That's an important social entrepreneurship kind of aspect. The fact that Luleka teaches courses in the local language of that community that she works in. That speaks to language and culture and Ubuntu and belonging. That's an important social entrepreneurship aspect. So nothing is too big or too small, or too narrow or too broad to be a good social entrepreneurship topic to focus on. Mm-hmm. My suggestion would be to anybody who's interested in applying is, what are you passionate about? You could be passionate about water, but that's not sexy right now, so I'm not going to do water. Whatever you are passionate about, you can make sexy or appealing. You can run that, because it's like what Luleka's now tasked to do. Take that winnings and do something with it. If you're not passionate about it, you're not going to do anything. You're going to want to chill.
Key leadership advice from both your lessons, you know, from running a community project and from running businesses that failed, like you said.
Why do you smile when you say it?
No, I think it's one of the misconceptions that we need to address. That a lot of the guys that make it are the guys that fail more than the others. You know, there's a saying that goes, the master has failed more times than the beginner is willing to try. So what are the key lessons that you've learned from those experiences and from yourself, Luleka, as well?
Mine is, be that dynamic leader. So no failure must be the same as, oh, I failed here the last time as well. No. Then you're a failure and you're going to remain a failure. So be dynamic, be innovative, be... know what you don't know and then seek that out. My Standard 5 teacher said, he who knows not and knows not he knows not is a fool. Leave him. And that's what I've learned.
That's very powerful.
I think for me as well, two things. One is, as Fazli has said, that you must be open to rejection.
Okay.
Don't take rejection too badly. Don't take it personally. So sometimes the people that reject you just don't get your idea at that time. Or maybe it's not relevant at that time. So as Fazlin says, take the idea, even if you've gotten the rejection. Rework the idea if you have to rework the idea. And if it's not a great idea, it's okay to say, yes, I understand it's not going to work. I need to go back to the base and start from scratch. So you be open to rejection. Don't take it personally. The second one, I would say engage.
Okay.
Engagement is so important. So for me, with communities, I've had to engage with so many people because I've wanted the solution to come from the communities.
Okay.
I didn't want it to be my solution, but I wanted it to be their solution.
Sure.
So as part of civil society, I'll say, you have to engage with government. I have to talk to the Department of Education. I have to talk to the schools. And then also, I have to talk to private sector, because we don't have that much money. We need private sector to help us with the initiatives that we're doing. So know that you're going to talk to a lot of people, and also a lot of diverse people. So be open into talking to the different people, because we don't know who's going to come alongside and say, I want to help you. So be willing to be open-minded as to that someone from anywhere really is the person that can help you.
Well, thank you very much for coming through and spending time with the Youth Leadership Platform. I think a conversation like this is a conversation we can keep having over time. But this will conclude our first part of, you know, social entrepreneurship and how we can leverage on dynamic leadership to solve problems within our societies, you know, as part of the Youth Leadership Platform. So to our listeners, you can stay tuned for the next, which is part two, on our podcast front, on the Youth Leadership Platform on Cliff Central. It's YLP Cliff Central on Twitter and Instagram, and Youth Leadership Platform on Facebook. If you've been listening to Cliff Central, you'd know that it's the Youth Leadership Platform time. And this is part two of leveraging on dynamic leadership and social entrepreneurship, really, to help change the perception of society about the problems that we have, and help society as well try and figure out and configure ways and solutions to solve some of the biggest problems that we have. And for this part of the conversation, I'm joined by two dynamic leaders again, which is Ubabu Phumlani as well as Anele. And I'm going to have them introduce themselves right away. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us on your show, Bongani. Thank you very much. Should I start?
Yeah.
Okay.
You may go ahead, but I'd love Upupumlani to say something before we go any. Anyway,
thank you for having me.
All right, cool. You might want to speak up a bit there, all right. So the projection is speak and span.
Okay.
Cool.
So on my side, my name is Anelim Kuzomahape.
Sure.
And I run a company called the African Entrepreneurship Initiative.
Yes.
Which we started in 2016 on the 1st of July. So we've been running now just over a year. And our main focus is it's a entrepreneurship development company.
Okay.
But with a specific focus on youth-owned enterprises in okay. townships and peri-urban areas. Yeah.
So let's define youth. What would youth mean in this context?
So youth in terms of BBB codes would be 18 to 35.
Okay.
So that's our main focus, and black-owned companies.
Okay. Yeah. Primarily, or that's that?
51% black-owned at least.
Okay, cool. Yes. All right. And yourself?
Okay, my name is Pumlani. I run a company called Beehive Capital.
Yes.
We do enterprise and supply development. Our pay of line is development that changes lives. So we design enterprise programs for corporates and the public sector. And we always say we just want to do programs that develop people, keep on teaching and teaching without any results being seen. So we're very mindful of what the programs we take the people through, and we want to see results at the end of it, of the programs. Yeah.
You've been in the industry for quite some time now. Looking at some of the specs, doing my own research, it stretches back to the late 90s. And you've kind of worked your way to where you are right now. What are some of the highlights of your journey culminating to where you are right now with Beehive Capital?
I think some of our colleagues that have spoken have kind of highlighted. I think we live in a society where we have this extreme makeover thing where we want instant things.
Okay.
So we have this thing that we believe we should have instant leadership, but leadership is not instant. It's a progress that you go through life. And further to that, I always say if we're constantly looking for extreme makeover, the next big thing, we will not identify a leader, because leaders come over a period of time. So you need to see what people have done in the past. I like my colleague, she says she's failed a few times, but she failed going forwards. And in the process of failing you makes you a better leader. And I kind of have gone through the process where I came from a banking environment. I thought I knew everything. So I jumped across the road and I put proposals together. And it was such a weird feeling. People sitting across the table that used to be a colleague telling you, no, we can't find you for X, Y reasons. But guys, I know everything. So it's been that journey that I've gone through that hopefully I can use to impart to the next generation of leaders.
And for you, Anele, what inspired starting an initiative like this and trying to help entrepreneurs? To begin off with, entrepreneurship is still a taboo in a lot of communities. Yeah. It's something that 1% of the world has gotten right, and conversations amongst them as well.
Yeah. So I think for me, what inspired me, I actually used to work at GIVS for the Enterprise Development Academy.
Yes.
So I was designing programs for entrepreneurs, and that's how actually I met Pumlani as well.
Okay.
So they do great work, but I think for me, my personal focus had to be youth. It made sense for me at the time, because we have the biggest youth unemployment rate, and not everyone's going to find a job, but they may be able to start a business and sustain a business. And I think in we take it lightly that we say in townships, you know, there's no entrepreneurs. Most people in townships have grown up with their parents with spaza shops, with, you know, there's enterprising happening in those areas, but we haven't taught people how to sustain and grow those enterprises, how to really own their own value system. Because you'll find that in Soweto, at Pick and Pay will come in. Why are people not owning their own supply, their values chain, you know? So it's those things for me that were important, but also to understand that when running these programs, language becomes a barrier.
Sure.
So it's important for us to have multilingual facilitators that facilitate, so that if you decide you want to present your presentation in Zulu or Tswana, you can do that, you know? You don't feel now you are less of a person because now you can't speak English well. And I think it's things like that give people their dignity, and they become confident. Like, if I can speak in my own language, then I know what I'm talking about, and doesn't feel like now I'm a struggle with English. So it was all those things and that made me want to start it, you know, and see other youth businesses grow and that in the future they'll be employing people.
Talking about people owning their own value systems within their own communities, thinking about in a lot of township situations right now, there's a lot of like Ethiopians and other foreign nationals that have come in and they've got this big business model that benefits them. Allegedly, on any given day, they make about 15K from those shops. Yeah. So you can think about how much they make a month and a year. And they don't employ a lot of people as well. And you think about the whole system as well of them combined in all these different townships, and how many of their stores are there in one particular township? How much money are they making? And why are black people not leveraging on that, and building on that and owning that and making that money to develop the areas themselves? It's a very moving subject.
Yeah, so I think for me personally, I always say that if you can go to another country,
sure,
where you don't speak the language, you don't know anyone, and make a success of a business, then you deserve that market. And I think for us as black people, we need to start saying, what can I learn from these communities? Because the one big thing that they do well is collaboration. So what they'll do when they get to any township or whatever, they'll find out who else is there, they'll collaborate so that they, when they buy in groups, and then they can get discounts, which is why then their products might be cheaper than the next person.
Sure.
So it's things like that where we need to stop fighting a competitor and realize that there's something that they're doing better than you, then how can I learn from that and do it better? Because this is your playground, but you're failing at it. How do we learn then and teach each other to do the same, if not better?
Okay, can I just touch on
that?
I'm glad you brought that point up, because the last two programs we ran, we actually ran with spaza shops, one in Freedom Park and other one in Ivory Park. And one of the things that we've learned, which she highlights, is that normally the people emigrate, normally the entrepreneurial people that come through, and they're able to succeed. And what you also learn when you travel, I mean, I was privileged to go to London and I discovered all the fish and chips shops are run by either Chinese or run by the Indians exclusively. So the challenges we have is not uniquely South African.
Sure.
It's a challenge that we have on a global basis.
Hmm.
But more importantly, when she talks about collaboration and understanding the value chain, I always give an example when we do the sessions in the township, that the airtime industry, the prepaid airtime industry, is like 6 billion rand a month business.
Wow.
So I sit with the enterprise and say, how many of you make 10,000 rand profit out of the airtime industry amongst all sellers? And none of them make that kind of money.
Huh.
And the trick there is actually understand how does the airtime industry work. And often we normally stand back and say, we criticizing people, how do they make so much money? And we don't take the time to actually understand what the value chain is about.
Sure.
The minute you do that, then you start understanding what the issues are. And one of the my pet hates of the work that we do at Gives is that we have entrepreneurs who are entrepreneurs by default. They come across a great opportunity and they don't do any work in terms of research and understanding the industry, and they fall on a good wicket. But when the hard times come, they can't adapt and start understanding what the business is all about. So one of the key things we try and teach the entrepreneurs we work with is that who understand the value chain as much as you can to the nth degree, because the dynamics change all the time and they change regularly. So you need to have
What are some of the things that, or principles that entrepreneurs need to understand about morphing with your business? Because when you are a startup and you always treat your business as a startup, it will always be a startup.
Yeah,
but for it to change, there's certain things that need to come into place. We look at Nokia, actually, at some point, of all the phones that were sold in any particular year, 60% were Nokia phones that were sold. 2 years later, only 2% of the market they owned. That fall, that change. A lot of entrepreneurs do not understand that. So enlighten us.
So I think the first kind of mistake entrepreneurs make, or startups, is that I've got a great technical skill. For example, you created radio and whatever, and you decide, okay, I'm going to go open a radio station.
Sure.
Running a business is a totally different thing. You know, you have a technical skill, but you need to have a business skill.
Sure.
You know, there's marketing, there's sales, there's all these things that you don't probably don't know of. So those are the things you need to educate yourself around. Mm. You need to understand the market. Are you actually solving a problem, or is it just something that's a fad and then in 2 years' time it's going to be gone?
You know, or there won't be a need for it.
There won't be a need. So if you really have a good understanding of the problem you're solving, you're more likely to be sustainable, because when things shift and change, it's still a requirement. It's still a problem that's there that requires to be solved. Mm. So I think it's those things that startups must be very cognizant of, but also they need to be curious and find out everything. Like, learn, read, find out what other people are doing in different countries. You find sometimes ideas aren't new to you.
Sure.
There's probably somebody who's doing it somewhere else. Find out how they're doing it in that market. You know, how can I implement? How can I change? What do I need to put in place? So you have to want to know more and do more and talk to other people, collaborate. Mm-hmm. People think, oh, someone's going to steal my idea. Your idea is really not that new. it really isn't. Like, you're not reinventing the wheel. So talk to people, collaborate, ask around, start things and network. So it those things will take you really far.
So one of the programs that Gibbs does on the entrepreneurial space is about knowing yourself. I think it's called mastering yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably one of the three most important skills that you need. You need to know who you are. And like she said, just because you're a great radio person, you're a great business person.
Sure.
And when you get to that level, then you're able to get people with the skills. For example, entrepreneurs, they want to be accountants. And accountants, we see it all the time. It's a very difficult thing to do. Just know that you're not a numbers person and you need someone to help you through the SaaS process, through doing all the business and that kind of stuff. And when you do that, you actually free yourself to do other things. Mm-hmm. And I think because entrepreneurs, they have this drive, they think they can do everything, and yet you can't do everything by yourself. Which brings my next point about mentorship. I mean, people have walked the journey before, many, many, many people.
Sure.
So why try and reinvent the wheel and have scars and lose a lot of blood? Just go to people who have gone through the process and get mentors to help you through the process. And again, entrepreneurs always think they know it all. Mm. They shy away from getting entrepreneurs. And we encourage people to get entrepreneurs because you actually quicken the pace of learning, because
sure,
you're someone who's gone through the process 3-4 times, and they'll tell you, if you go this route, you're going to come short. Why do you want to keep going through that route? You know?
You're going to burn out.
Mm. Exactly.
And you're gonna get burnt, and then you're just gonna give up.
Yeah.
What are the makings of an ideal entrepreneur? Because everyone these days, you know, seemingly now thinks, I don't want to be in school. You hear people talking about, I don't want to be part of the system, so I want to start my own business and get into entrepreneurship. What are the makings of an ideal entrepreneur or an entrepreneur?
I'm going to say something that's very controversial.
Sure.
Entrepreneurship is hard.
Yeah.
I'm not discouraging people. Entrepreneurship is hard.
Yeah.
And I think some of it falls on us who kind of done well. We don't sit back and tell the people what you No one talks about the cars they've lost,
sure,
or the relation that they've broken. But entrepreneurship is hard. But having
houses
said that,
have been repossessed.
Exactly. But having said that, I think once you've decided you want to go through that route, you got to say, I got to have a thick skin about it. And rejection is a constant thing. You get rejected by your friends. You get rejected by the banks. And everyone around you rejects you.
And it's so easy
to fall off the cliff and say, you know, I'm giving up on the idea just when you're about your thing. So again, that's it, the time that you need mentors around you, people who say, listen, I think you're on a great path, you just need to be touching 1, 2, 3, you get there. Otherwise, if you haven't got anyone around you, you lose the space. And again, in the program that we do, we find the people there to keep motivating the people and saying, look, you know, keep going, you're going to get there.
Yeah, I agree with Pumlan. I think staying power is one thing you need to have, you know, and you need to believe in the reason you started, like, and believe in yourself, because I think when you're starting out and when hard times come, that's when you question things and you're like, but it doesn't make sense. And you have to look at your peers are doing 10 times as well, you know, they're in corporate, they've got secure jobs, they know on the 25th that SMS is coming, you know, they're driving the latest cars, they're traveling, and you have to be like, okay, that's not for me right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important to cut down when starting and just put your head down and work. It's work. You can't be lazy. You're not gonna, even if you employ people, if your work ethic is not great, they're not gonna have a great work ethic,
because
they're gonna learn from the leader. So you need to be that great leader and lead by example.
When do you stop? When do you decide that this idea will just not work and I need to move on to the next biggest idea. Because it can be very tricky and challenging because just when you let go and someone is like, I recognize and I want to be part of, but now you've already let go. So, but how do you decide that?
So I think that's also part of when you, so if you've done design thinking, there's you have to question your market and test, validate your idea and all of that stuff. So during that whole entire process, at some point you are getting those, no, there really isn't a market for this. You know, if you've done your proper research.
Sure.
And with that, sometimes it's not maybe just letting go of the idea. It's maybe shelving it for another time.
Okay.
Or maybe saying, okay, how do I pivot? And now, because you've spoken to your customer, maybe they like, I don't want this, but I want this.
Yeah.
Now you're starting to think, oh, okay, maybe other people might want this. And then you pivot and you change. But I think you want to fail fast and fail forward. Fail quickly, dust yourself up and start again. You know, you don't want to stay and retain something that's not working.
You got to be adaptive, and I think entrepreneurs, what often happens, entrepreneurs, they come and say, I'm selling this black headphones,
sure,
and I'm going to sell black headphones to everyone, and the market kind of tells you, we want transparent headphones, and you're not listening because you want to sell this thing. The next guy says, I want red transparent headphones, you're not listening because you got this idea. So one of the things about entrepreneurship is being able to adapt to realize that this idea is not working.
Okay.
I need to go back, either rethink it or move to something else. And I think most entrepreneurs, they struggle with that concept because, you know, you've left work, you've put so much money into it, and I want to make this thing, but this thing is not working. But at some point you gotta realize, this is not working, I gotta move to the next thing, because if you keep pushing this, it's not gonna happen. But maybe just to sidetrack, I mean, you talked about a question or entrepreneur, how do people become entrepreneur? And one of the things that we teach is to kind of like say, hopefully one day some of us are going to be parents here, is to say, what do you teach your kids in terms of entrepreneurship? And
sure.
My journey, certainly, it was one of those things where I think I was probably finishing last year of school, and my dad kind of said to me, listen, you can go and work, you can live okay, but you can be an entrepreneur and be wealthy. And I never listened to him for so many years. And I did the route of going to school, going to varsity and doing all this. But something kept nagging me, saying, I got to do this thing.
Sure.
So for me, the one thing is that parents play a very important role. And more importantly, the people who come from the townships, when you've done well, you got to go back to those communities and kind of say, you know, this is what entrepreneurship is about. Because there are a lot of people who have no idea what to do about entrepreneurship. And if we leave the townships, who's going to mentor those people in the townships? And perhaps the last thing is to kind of say, also my mother, she was very entrepreneurial. At that point, I never thought about it, but she would always make jerseys and make dresses and make things and sell to supplement. But at that time, you're growing up, you know, you're busy with your
own. You're not even thinking about
that. But the value of parents and also just the mentorship that is like a subliminal mentorship that you go through is very important in the life of entrepreneurs that we work with.
Gee. So because of time, last question. If you were president for one day, what would you change for entrepreneurs in South Africa? And we'll start with Anel.
Oh, wow. Thanks, Wong. I think one thing would probably be tax.
Okay.
Definitely.
What about tax?
Firstly, I think for the first 3 to 5 years of entrepreneurship, entrepreneurs shouldn't be taxed. Or if they are, there needs to be a tax relief. I think for me, I personally think that's one of the biggest hindrances that entrepreneurs experience. As Fazlin mentioned, you come back and you have like this huge tax bill, you know, and you're still getting, when do you reinvest?
Sure.
So I think that's what I'd do.
Okay.
For me, I would say it's dissemination of information. And I'll give you a simple example.
Sure.
The bread industry is a simple thing. We have spaza shops that order 10 loaves a day from a thing, and the price they get, they can never compete. So what we've done is to say, why don't you look at the whole township as one market? We will deal with the issues. Now, when you're looking at a market and you're saying these guys are buying 5,000 loaves a day, the price that you get is very different. Although at a smaller level, they're buying 10 loaves each per spaza shop, but if you're getting 5,000, the price they get is very different. For me, it's just getting information to the entrepreneurs. It's very critical for them to understand the market.
Guys, thanks a lot for coming through as well and sharing that knowledge. And we will put up the information to it's www.beehivecapital.co.za, and we've got www.aeinitiative.co.za. So you can go and check it out to our Youth Leadership Platform listeners. I remember to be part of the conversation on YLP Cliff Central on Twitter and Instagram, and You can get a hold of me on at Simply Bongani across all social medias. Tell us what you think about the shows. Tell us what you want to hear more. Tell us what issues and what kind of guests you want to have in the forthcoming shows so that we can help you move society through leadership. From the Leadership Platform and myself and my wonderful guests, it's good day and God bless for now.
This is CliffCentral.com.